Yo, check this out. This is Fresh Get Out of the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the Blunt Master P.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C-Murder.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfuckers.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Dizzy Ball.
Vice One.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is a show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records revealing the shit, and rappers are coming up, getting put on. We need the platform to fight amazing. The show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on the screen and follow up Windows.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing and mastering, graphics and shadow design. Check out the archives and hundreds of shows. Plenty of content for you to get through. Everything free to download and stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real.
We got
control,
we brought our bitch, we represent. All them chillers on the mic and we show love to all you fans. Baby, keep the focus, bringing nothing but the rhythm. Come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy, knocking all you rappers off. It's underground society, it's usually just for life. Dog, hip-hop, AD, represent for them legends. Rapping mumble, rapper, solo, me, sitting on the hips. Two-pocket beats, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. This is a Murder Master Music Show. Free the homie gangsta, bro. I see these rappers on these streets. I got my chopper about to blow. Stay up on that raw shit, uncut street shit.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez, Murder Master Music Show. Today we got a special treat for you. We're going to be interviewing Hannah Ali, who is the daughter of the greatest, Muhammad Ali. She's got a wonderful new book out called At Home with Muhammad Ali. Hannah, how you doing?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a huge honor, and I got the book, and it's a very personal book about a father told by a daughter, you know, and I know it had to have been hard for you to do this book. How did you get through it? I know you've done other books in the past, but how did you get through this one, being that your father is no longer with us?
Well, I actually started writing it before he passed away, and I've read him various chapters. So I sold it to the publisher, accepted a deal a month before he passed. So what became difficult, but they were very gracious. They gave me a year off. So, you know, I just signed the deal 1 month before he passed. And listening to the tape recordings was always a little difficult, but it became even more so, as you can imagine. So I took a break, and then I just dove back in. But it was a challenge to write. I had never written any type of memoir before, that style of writing. I just sort of did, like, you know, little essays and sort of put it together. So this was a challenge because I'm telling three stories in one. You have my relationship with my father, my father's relationship with my mother, and my father, what he was going through at this time in his life. Because so many movies, documentaries, books, everything stops usually after the Foreman fight. And after he retired for that third time, before he came back out of retirement to fight Larry Holmes, he had made a lot of recordings. He had a lot more time to be at home with the family. So in 1979, really 78, but the majority of the tapes are 79 through 82, even though they span all the way to 86. He made so many recordings of us just singing, laughing, and talking about his worries, his concerns, trying to free hostages in Tehran and documenting the conversations between him and Carter in the White House and how he opened the lines of communication. You know, he offered to go over and give himself in replace of the 59 hostages that were being held in the American embassy in Tehran at the time. And had opened, the mere mentioning of his name opened the lines of communication. So he's documenting all this. He's documenting whether or not he should come back to the ring and fight Larry Holmes. And he's documenting his concerns and all the people he's taking care of and all the money that's going out and his worries. And it's very humanizing, and he did it, and he constantly on every tape, random tapes, you're going to appreciate I did this one day. You'll be happy I did this. This is for you. So he knew what he was doing. Daddy was always ahead of his time. And when I discovered them, I told him, I said, this is the world's first reality show, essentially. He's doing things before anyone even thought to do it. So, you know, just traveling the world in airports and taking us to school, singing in the morning. There's one tape I like. It starts at 12 midnight, and he's just came home from Peking, China. They wanted him to help bring boxing back to China. So he comes home in time for Christmas, the day before Christmas, which people find interesting, is we were allowed to have a Christmas tree in our bedroom. He was a Muslim. My mother was Catholic. He let us have Christmas. and try to explain what our beliefs were supposed to be at the same time, and that we were celebrating the spirit of giving. But he comes home in time for Christmas, and I guess I woke him up. I was three and a half years old, and I loved popsicles. And his tape, the tape opens with, "This is Muhammad Ali at 55 Fremont Place, and the date is January 24th, 1979. I'm here in bed, and Hannah, you just woke me up. And it's 12 midnight, and you just woke me up and told me to go downstairs and get you a popsicle. There was no popsicles left, so now you sent me back down to get you a pickle." He's like, "Okay, signing off." So little things like that throughout, you know. So it was a blessing to have the recording. Priceless, right?
Yeah. So many people don't have those recordings of their fathers or whatever, you know, yeah, you're right. It's like he was almost planning for something in the future. It's almost right. Like he knew maybe you would be able to put those words, you know, in book form someday.
And he constantly talks about that, too. He says, you know, I think he thought he didn't know how they'd be used. He just knew that they might be important one day. I used to tell him that I thought he was psychic, but he didn't believe it. He would predict when planes were going to crash. I mean, as you know, in history, he predicted like 26 times in a row. Accurately the rounds his opponent would fall in. And I always said he's a little psychic and other things too, but he just never believed it. But I think that he had a feeling, profound feeling, and he knew that they would be important, and he just didn't know how. So, but anyway, go on. What were you saying?
No, that's amazing, yeah. You know, that he documented everything. But I was reading through the book, and you were talking about Christmas. He caved in and let you guys have Christmas.
Daddy was one of those people where he believed strongly in his faith, but he was also very lenient. And, you know, he wanted us to enjoy life. You know, he says on the tapes, "There's no way I can keep this from you. Where I'm trying to raise you all Muslim, but Christmas is everywhere. And you wanted a tree and you wanted some gifts." So, so he let us have it. And he's making a tape as we're opening our gifts when I'm 4 and 5 and 6 years old, always reminding us why he's letting us have Christmas and that we were Muslims. So he was so funny. But I think that it's just another one of those qualities about him, I think, that made him so special. And you know, my father gave you room to just live and enjoy life and be free. And he tried to teach us about value spiritually and morally and just humane things that all human beings should care about, like other people and their feelings. But at the same time, he wasn't he didn't take things too serious. You know, when he was standing up in front of the world and had to stand up for his rights, and it was a little different. But at home, you know, he wanted his kids to have a happy life. And he did grow up, you know, with Christian parents. So I think that's another reason, you know, that he did remember what it felt like to have a Christmas tree and to wake up to a gift. So he wanted us to have that experience.
That's awesome. You know, another thing in the book that I found very interesting, of all the fights he had, the one he remembers the most was the Rumble in the Jungle. You know, what were some of the things that you remember, you know, from him speaking about that fight?
It wasn't necessarily the one he remembered the most. It's the one he thought was the most important. The fight he, I think, never forgot was his very first fight. Ronnie O'Keefe, he would always say, you know, the one, his very first fight. But the Rumble in the Jungle was the most important fight to him. And that is because he had only lost his title originally because the government had stripped it and taken it from him and never thinking he'd go back to the ring. Then to go back to the ring and find out that Joe Frazier, when he stepped in the ring with him, was deserving of that title that he got to lose, and then have the roadblock of George Foreman, a fighter that both Frazier and Ken Norton, two fights that he had lost 1 out of 3 to, not at the time, just lost 1 to, you know, got knocked, annihilated in the ring with Foreman. So now he has to go through Foreman and still wants to go back and get Frazier, you know? So I think that the fight with Foreman meant it so much to him because nobody in the world but himself believed he could do it. And that was huge. So, and it put him back on the platform. And that's when I think people started actually saying, you know, he's the greatest. Even the commentator that announced it, "Oh, my God, the great man has done it. He must be the greatest," you know, when they announced that he won the fight. So that was always the most important fight to him. And the fights he spoke about the most were always the Frazier fights. And the fight that he always remembered and never forgot, of course, was the very first fight. You know, and they all had a different, you know, I think a different place of importance for him because of how they went down in history. So.
And I love how you touch on, too, how later in life, him and George became great friends.
There's a part in your book where you talk about him pulling up on George, and George is standing, you know, on a box preaching to people out in the street. What's your relationship been like with George throughout
George,
the years?
George is like a second father. So we've been friends for a long time, friends with his daughters, a couple of them. And it started back when I discovered the tape, and I tried to contact George and told him about the tape and gave him a copy. And ever since then, we kept in touch. It was around 2003. And we've been friends ever since. So he's like a second dad. He's so sweet. So he's I always made sure my father, I dialed the number for him, let him talk and keep him abreast of how my father was doing. And he stayed in touch. He's always helpful. He's always supportive in any way he can. And he was a huge help to me when my father passed, you know. So I think that, you know, George Foreman actually, you know, he has a huge heart. And people, I knew that when people would find that just amazing that, you know, the people, especially sports fans, will be shocked to know that they were actually friends and how they had this conversation. And Dad recorded it for an hour talking about God and religion. And George Foreman's Christian. He's trying to get my father to come back to Christianity. And my father's trying to explain that people that kill in the name of Islam are not true Muslims, and it's a peaceful religion. And they're doing it. They're talking about this heated this topic amicably. And, you know, George Foreman is also warning him, this is before he came out of retirement to fight Larry Holmes, that he had a vision that he was going to be lured out and don't do it. And my dad is trying to convince George, because at the time George had sold all his possessions. He got, you know, went through depression when he lost to my father. He ended up retiring and sold all of his possessions and started preaching to people on the street, literally. So that's how Daddy found him, driving in Texas, like out of a movie scene. And he was there standing in a vacant dirt lot in the night, preaching to just a crowd of people. Daddy hopped out the car, ran across the street. They exchanged numbers. So that was George Foreman calling him. And my father, of course, pushed record on the tape player. So George didn't know. So he was surprised and happy to receive it and hear it, that the recording. But Daddy's trying to convince George Foreman to come back to boxing. Don't go out a loser, go out a winner. You know, you can still box. And, of course, he did do that a few years later. But at the time, he wasn't budging, and my father wasn't budging. He was, you know, didn't plan on going back to the ring, but it ended up being lured back in a year after the conversation. So very interesting stuff, yeah.
Well, do you recall your father's thoughts when George came back and won in the same trunks that he wore when he lost to your father all those years later?
I know, that's amazing. I didn't even know that detail. I've never read it, never heard it. So that's new information to me. That's very interesting how that works. But I'm not surprised. You know, George Foreman is very spiritual. My father is very spiritual. And whenever you have that type of spirit and character and you utilize that and use that, you have, another level of strength that isn't really described easily in words. And it's like an inner faith. And nothing but the forces of all positivity in the universe help you reach your goal. So George Foreman was very spiritual and positive, and, you know, it was part of his life, and he was blessed. You know, he gave up something, he walked away. And, you know, there were very similar stories, him and my father, in both ways. You know, Daddy left the sport. He didn't do it willingly. They took his title, but, you know, he had to pay his dues and came back. And George did the same. You know, he voluntarily left, but he did it, paid his dues, and he came back. So I'm not surprised at all, because they're very much alike in that way. And, you know, George Foreman is such a sweet, loving, caring, kind man. He deserves all the blessings.
So speaking of Vietnam, I just recently interviewed former Governor Jesse Ventura. Mm-hmm. Not only did he recite "I Am the Greatest" by your dad, but he also had some very kind words as a Vietnam veteran himself to say about your father. This is him talking about Vietnam. We'll be right back.
Okay.
And he stood for what he stood for. He gave up the greatest title in the world. He was the world heavyweight champion, and they wanted him to go to war, and he refused. And they took his title from him in his prime, and they took his way to make money, and he was willing to go to prison. And you're talking to a Vietnam veteran here who looks at him with admiration because he stood up for what he believed in. He was willing to go to prison over it. He didn't have a doctor write a false report that he had bone spurs on his feet and commit a felony to get out of it. He was willing to go to jail for what he believed in.
That's very powerful.
Yeah.
Former governor.
Well, you know, I'm used to it, and I've had daddy for as long as I've lived, so I'm used to hearing people talk about things like this. I'm used to seeing people come up to him and just start crying, and thanking him. You know, this is a man who, my father, when we would drive past homeless people in the street, he would put them in our car because we had empty rooms, and he thought it was a sin to have so many bedrooms in our mansion in Los Angeles. And he sees a family that needs somewhere to stay. He brought them home, and I'm not kidding you, that was a regular occurrence. So my mother then turned around and put them in hotel rooms and paid the bills for a month in advance. But that was Daddy. He'd go find a hotel room and take him shopping and eat and take him in the Bob's Big Boy. If there was a homeless man hungry in the street, he'd just hand them money, bring them in the restaurant with us, and we had to sit there. And I was a little girl. I didn't know better. So I just knew that someone smelled funny and looked dirty, and I was eating with him a lot. So because me and my dad went to Carnations and Bob's Big Boy on Wilshire Boulevard when it was still there. But, you know, it's now, I think it's a BMW dealer now where Bob's Big Boy was. But, yeah, that was like everyday life. And we grew up with such a great example of a human being, of just what, you know, what a human being should aspire to be in every level. His heart, his, you know, his athleticism, everything about him, his inner self-aware belief and awareness and love for people. So it doesn't surprise me. It just makes me feel proud, you know, everything. I say, well, I'm just so happy to have my father's blood running in my veins. I feel incredibly blessed to have had him as a father. And, I'm happy to hear things like that because it's very true. And he's my father wasn't one to complain ever. He never complained. You probably will never find footage of him saying mad at or upset or trying to make excuses for the fact that his prime was taking away. They always say 3 years, but it was 3.5 years of his prime gone. So, fighting. So it's like he never looks back. Even with Parkinson's, he never complained. He always found the positive in it. I'm helping other people get out of bed and keep going, or it could be worse. I'm not in pain. He always found the positive view inside of side of things and everything in life, even with headaches. And you never heard him complain about anything. It's like that was just, we had to watch him close in life. I mean, he passed kidney stones and never complained. Lonnie just knew one day when she looked in the toilet. And I know that's very graphic, but just to give you an idea of just how serious, like I'm serious here when I say he never complained about pain, about emotional or physical. He just bared it and just kept going forward. So that was just how he was. And I'm very proud. I know that people love him, and there's a lot of people that don't know who he is coming up, you know, young kids and people. And I wanted to write this book because there was a whole other side of him that people just don't know about. And some people do, a lot of people do, but there's a huge, you know, a chunk of people that don't as well. And I thought, why not just share something that's new? It's not about boxing. There's, you know, or anything like that. It's just his home life, the things that he was dealing with and how he dealt with Parkinson's and the onset of that, how I dealt with it as a little girl, watching it happen young, not understanding, dealing with the separation of my parents. I blamed my mother for leaving my father, all of that. So, and then in the middle of writing the memoir, we go to storage with my mother, and I discover these love letters that he wrote her that she never even knew existed. So I put that all in the back of the book so people can see the actual handwritten letters and the things that I'm talking about in the book. Because, the book was supposed to be half the size and have one fifth the amount of photographs that are in it. So it's like over 80 photographs and 450-60 pages because I just didn't know how to shorten it. And I wrote the book myself, and I just read a bunch of how-to books,
which is amazing.
Put it together.
what your father did. He gave to the people, and I feel you doing that is a way of giving to the people as well. You mentioned the Parkinson's.
Thank you.
I read a part in your book, which was very touching. He talks about he didn't feel, like you said, he didn't feel sorry for himself at all. He wanted to pen a letter to the fans to let them know that he's okay. It meant so much to him just to let people know that, hey, I'm going to be fine. I'm not going nowhere. I'm still the greatest.
Because the interviewer wanted to know, what do you say to people who feel sorry for you? He said, feel sorry for me? Why? Everywhere I go, I'm loved. I'm invited by kings and queens all over the world. I got more fans than any one person can ever wish or dream for. I've got beautiful wife, beautiful children. I live in a mansion. I have people, you know, feel sorry for what? But we're in a society in the world where people are just usually the glass is half empty, complaining, why me? That just was never my father's spirit. It was to look to the blessings that you have, you know, and to experience feelings, whether they're negative, sad, happy, whatever, joy, and let them pass through you. And the positive ones and the good ones just stay permanent. So it's not that he isn't human. He's very human. He just did not dwell in sorrow, regret, and ever pity himself. You know, he had too much pride and love and understanding, spiritual awareness and understanding and acceptance for that. But he was a very wise and old soul. So, I mean, he didn't come down to the earth and having to learn some of these great lessons that people are struggling with. He came down with knowledge of a lot of it and was here for other reasons. So I think that, and that's just evident in the way he lived his life and the courage in which he faced the challenges of life. So I think that my father was just, like, you know, it's hard to look and find the heroes, examples of true heroes anymore, even in the way he handled his indiscretions with women. You know, he brought all of his children together every summer, all of the kids he had, even out of wedlock, the dog is scratching the couch.
Oh, Cash.
I named him after my grandfather. This is Cash. So my father together and taught us to love each other and told us that he wanted us to grow up and be friends and respect each other and that we were family, and that's exactly what happened. We were always on group texts. All of us get along. We grew up friends because he brought us together. So, and that's including the children he had out of wedlock every summer. So, I mean, this is just how he handled stuff. He didn't hide anything. He didn't – there's no secrets. A lot of the stuff is probably a lot of exaggerations in certain books because the truth is he just liked beautiful women. He liked to be married, and that's it. And I'm glad because, like I said, we're all here. So my dad, just like any man, especially when you're that handsome and that charismatic and women are throwing themselves at you, I'm sure it's very difficult. But it's how you handle mistakes, I think. And the way he handled them was just very admirable. He didn't hide anyone. He did. All of his divorces were held out of court. You know, he got along with all of his wives. I mean, this tape recording of him talking to Belinda on the phone, laughing and joking about old times, and animosity between anyone or anyone. He was just an amazing human being. So that's the kind of stuff that people don't know. You know, and if I could really tell the whole story, it would just make him look even better. But I'd rather take the blame and make things look a certain way to protect women and other people in his life from embarrassment, because he's a man and the world is harder on women and, you know, more forgiving of men in these things. So there's so much they don't know, and people would assume that what they don't know is just negative stuff, but it's actually the opposite. If you knew it, the secrets that I talk about but don't reveal, you would just admire him more.
Another thing you wrote about in the book too was the visitors that would just randomly come over. Clint Eastwood would pop up, or Michael Jackson. Was that just normal for you?
Yes, that was, you know, Daddy, I didn't know who anyone was, really. The only person I knew of was, of course, Michael. But the other actors, and, you know, I didn't know who was there. But the funny thing is that what I share is how my father would make such a big deal about it. He liked to pump people up and make them feel good about themselves. So, you know, even the mailman, he would say, "This is the world's greatest mailman." So he'd make you feel like he'd meet someone special. "Oh, this is the world's greatest cook. Do you know who this is, Hannah? This is the world." So I, you know, when a celebrity came, did the same thing, but it was no different from the treatment of average everyday people with regular working jobs. And if anything, he pumped them up more than actual celebrities. So it was the norm. I think having a father like mine just changed my perspective. And, you know, I have no celebrity. Just because someone's famous does nothing for me. I'm not impressed. It's you really how what kind of human being people are, and that's about it. So I could care, you know, it just doesn't faze us, or at least maybe because of the way we were raised, or the fact that our father was so famous and loving and kind, it just made me it made it a little more difficult for me to be impressed with people, especially when they had, you know, excessive fame or wealth, and depending on what they're doing with it, they're held to a higher standard. Used to say that, you know, you don't get these blessings for nothing. You have a natural responsibility that comes with fame. And a lot of people want to say, "Oh, well, I'm not a role model. I didn't sign up for that." Well, you know, you can go get a job working at McDonald's then, or somewhere else, or just, you know, a regular job and just relax and let someone else do it. Because when you take that role, it's a natural responsibility that just comes with it. And I think that to society, to the world, to prosperity, to everyone that's looking up to you, and just my father knew that and honored it and took it very seriously. So it's hard to see people that don't really follow in those footsteps in general, or in that thinking, line of thinking, that are in a job that puts them in the spotlight and it's very public, but just don't like people. And they go, "Well, what are you doing this job?"
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, you're not supposed to judge.
That's one of the qualities about him. And it sounds like he passed it on to you, where you just don't look down upon people. you know, and you treat everybody equal. And I think that's why he's loved around the world the way he is, too.
He used to tell us. He'd say the world is going to treat you better because of who your father is, but nothing makes you better than anyone except for the quality of your heart. So if you want to be the greatest or to be the best, you want to be above, you know, feel that you're above a level above anyone. It's not your job, your wealth, your title, none of that. They're not real. They can be taken. You can go with you when you die. They're false and they're of this world. So it's only your heart, how decent you are, how kind you are, that really makes a person great or small. And he taught us that since we were like 5 years old. So it's like a repetitive story. A lot of the stories I share, they're just repetitive throughout my whole life with my father up until, you know, as long as he could talk fluently, he was telling the same stories, telling the same lessons, trying to guide us in the right path. He called it the righteous path.
He's loved by so many people. I mean, they got another documentary coming out. What's My Name? Obviously, you know about that. I imagine you're in it. LeBron James produced.
Yeah. Actually, we're not in it. It's not about, there's nothing to do with family at all in that film. And I only know this. I haven't seen it yet. My book is released. My book comes out May 7th. At Home with Muhammad Ali comes out May 7th. People can pre-order now if they want it at homewithmuhammadali.com. But it's in stores May 7th. And the film is premiering in L.A., so we're going to that premiere. That's going to be on May 8th. So I have a book signing at Barnes & Noble at the Grove on the 7th at 7 p.m. Then the next day I'm going to be at the premiere for What's My Name, the HBO film. But I read a review a few days ago, and I was you know, working with the I'm close with and was in discussion with the writer, Stephen Lockhart. And I read a review, and the review was saying that it gave me a glimpse into what to expect. There's absolutely nothing about family in it at all. So this is not going to be a documentary that has interviews. It's not done that way. It's literally my father's voice and telling his own story through old footage and video. So there's no interviews, and there's nothing about his children or his wives. So if anyone goes looking for that, they won't find it.
Because
right. So I'm kind of happy, to be honest with you, because it's never been done before. So even I Am Ali, which there's a film with Universal that I licensed a few minutes of the audio recordings to. That was back in 2014. That was probably the first documentary that showed anything. Right. So she licensed some of my audios for that. And 12 minutes of like 80 or 90 hours that I have. So I let them use 12 minutes, and they did that film. I thought it was important to do, and so I agreed. And that was the closest I've seen anything get to showing a little bit of him, the other side of him. So this is just even more in-depth because you're getting to see the humanity, the humility, him being sorry for cheating. I asked him why. I share that conversation we had. Him begging for another chance for my mother, writing the letters, and I never knew they existed, you know, and then just him worrying about money and all, and talking to different people on the telephone, his lawyers, and trying to decide whether he should come back out of retirement, and weighing the pros and the cons, dreams that he had. And I never knew about the boxing gym that he wanted to, or camp that he wanted to start. I forgot the name right now, my brain's not working, but it was a Triple Crown World Headquarters for boxers, and he would train fighters. All these things he wanted to do when he was in love with this land in Paso Robles, and he wanted to buy it. And that was one of the reasons he was thinking, well, if I fought again, I could buy the land. And, you know, so there was so much that I learned from listening to these recordings. I can't even tell you. I felt like I was a fly on the wall, like just time travel. And sometimes, you know, when you're watching a movie or you're watching something so intently, you almost lose yourself in it. I just felt like I was back in Fremont Place, which is the home we grew up at, 55 Fremont Place, which is actually on the market for sale right now, which is amazing. My dad bought it for, what, $2 million, and now it's on the market for, like, $17
million.
Wow. So, yeah, it's on the market now, and I think it's very historical. You know, President Obama's campaigns were held there, so he was in that house. My father lived in that house, and whatever else goes with the history of the home might be part of that. And, you know, homes appreciate with time. So, but $17 million is on the market. As we speak, for sale.
Of course. I mean, that right there, again, is a testament just to the,
you know, the legend of your father. But this book here, you know, in the movie I Am Ali, I remember there was a scene you were talking about. Your mom looked him in the eyes, and she seen God. You know, this book, we all look at him as a God figure, but this book, it humanizes him. Like you said, he's worrying about, you know, money and,
right.
and different things and situations. And I think it's very important people get that because, you know, what most of us just know about the fights, just know a little bit about a few of the interviews
right.
he had outside the ring. This
right.
is insight into who he was as a person. No one knows him better than, well, you, yourself.
Right. It's funny because thank you. Well, thank you. I'm happy to do it because, like I said, you know, my father belonged to the world, and he loved the world, and he needed people like he needed air to breathe. He was the kind of person that wanted to be out in the streets where people can walk up and touch him. He never kept a bodyguard with him, and they were there. They weren't really guarding people from coming up to him, so there's really no point with having one. But he did because, you know, he said, I'm not going to live life like that. If somebody wants to shoot me, nothing can stop them. God's my bodyguard. So as long as I'm supposed to be on this earth, I'll be on this earth. And he wanted the people to be able to walk up and touch him. So it's one of the reasons they call him People's Champ, because it was the truth. I mean, you know, he just loved people. You know, my dad, I don't know how to tell you, like, he loved people like you might love your child. Like, he just loved people. And he used to say he was a daddy to the world. So he wanted to help everybody. I recently just found this letter, and I wish I would have had it before the book was published so I could have included it to just sort of back up and show. They say show, don't tell. I wanted to show some evidence of this. But I write a little bit about how, you know, he's always helping people. And he went, so, you know, celebrities and people of wealth get letters all the time asking for money. My dad was constantly bombarded with that. Anybody in his position, I'm sure all of them go through it. Layla goes through it. And Layla just texted me last night because I shared this letter with her that a fan just sent me on Instagram. And it was funny because I read it. I said, oh, let me read this real quick. It had his big signature there and a little picture of him. And it was from Chicago, the Woodlawn House. And I thought that's probably the year before I was born. And it turned out it was 1975, because in the letter he mentions he has 6 kids. So it's before me and Layla. So basically it was just him responding to this man who was asking for money. And the young man that sent it to me had inherited it from his father. My father actually wrote his father the letter, somebody out of the country. And it was just so sweet and caring. And so my father, he takes the time to write this man back and say, you know, I get letters like yours all the time. And what I mean by that is people ask me for help and for aid. And that couldn't possibly help everybody. He's like, before I even get my money, he's telling him all his business, the government gets 50%. Then I have to take care of my mother. I have to take care of my father. You'll read or you'll listen to something similar. You'll read something similar in my book because I'm transcribing a recording where he's saying something similar to somebody else, but it was over the telephone, a family member. And, he took the time to write this man back and tell him, I really hope your dreams and wishes come true. But there's so many people I'm taking care of. And then I have my religion to think about. I have to spread the word of Islam, and that's going to take millions of dollars. And, you know, so I'm sorry I can't help you, but I would love, you know, I'll hopefully be able to come to your country one day. And if you can find me, I'll be glad to meet you. Best of luck to you, you know, sincerely, Muhammad Ali. And I sent it to Layla, and she was like, wow, he actually replied. I ignore those letters that I get. I said, exactly, that's the point. He took the time to write this man back, and probably everybody else, to tell him why he has to, you know, not give him any, he can't give him any money, or whatever it is he was asking for, I don't know. So that was my dad,
yeah.
though. You know, he up until the end, he wanted me to call, if we opened his fan mail, if somebody put their number, he had me call them. So, there could be people listening to this right now saying, oh, my God, it's true. They called me, you know, because we called so many people over the years. He would open letters looking for people to find numbers where people would actually leave a telephone number. And then it would get legendary. Somebody would go on the news or somebody would go on television or tell somebody that Muhammad Ali actually called me back. So it became an epidemic. People start putting the number inside of their letters, and he was always calling them. He'd get hung up on sometimes. No one believed him. So that's when he'd have me call and say, it's really him.
Wow.
So, you know, that was daddy. That was shared in all. That was also actually, an actual incident that was shared of that was in the film I Am Ali. Russ Ruthledge. Russ was his first name. I can never pronounce his last name properly. But Russ is in the film I Am Ali, and he's sharing the footage from his trip that my father, he wrote a letter to my dad. My dad happened. He was lucky. Daddy opened his letter. He had his number there. He called him and invited him to come stay in our house. complete stranger who just wrote him a fan letter asking for her autograph. And he came and stayed in our house, and he said, bring your camera. So he brought his camera, and he filmed it all. And now that's the footage you see on IMLE. That's that story. So that's one of so many I can't even tell you. So that was happening all the time. And just on a daily basis. we had an open door.
A lot of, I imagine people of all walks of life from around the world came to your home. But for you, it was just normal, everyday life. I said for you, it was just normal, everyday life.
Yes, yes. Well, a lot of celebrity children, I'm sure, would say the same. You know, when you're with people that are in music or in acting or in boxing, they have all the actors over. They have all the musicians are visiting them. But with my father, it was everybody. You had the musicians, you had the actors, you had the politicians. Everyone came to see him. he just, like he said, I guess everyone looked up to him. They loved and respected him. So he always wanted to be more than a boxer. He was very humble at the same time. He knew how great he was, but he was also very humble at the same time. So, you know, he would always ask, do people still remember me? And I'm like, are you kidding? Of course they still remember you. He was always afraid that people would forget him. I don't know where that came from. But, very humble.
And books like this, you know, he's already immortalized, but you're making him even more immortalized if that's even possible. You're doing that through this book.
I wanted people to know the true, my true father, his true essence of who he was, because everything else is also a part of him, but it was a public persona and in the public eye. So to be able to see the complete spirit of the human being from every angle, you know, home life, everything. You know, they know all his faults. There are no secrets. He didn't hide anything. You know, when he met my mother, he was married to Belinda. They were having their own problems. And he didn't try to hide her. He went around. The reason why the world even knew about her was he was openly taking her everywhere with him. So there were no secrets. So there's really nothing new to find out that is a secret that would diminish his legacy in any way. If anything, it would be quite the opposite. So, that's the truth.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, my father was also born in 42, and I know what you went through at the end, because my father passed last year in November.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rough, and, you know, we all have to go through that, unfortunately. And you talk about it in your book. How do you get through it day to day?
My father taught, it's part of life. My father taught us from a young age, probably too young, that we're all going to die one day. I was 5 years old. I didn't even want to go to sleep sometimes because of it. So I grew up knowing that he wouldn't be here forever. He was always saying this life is short. The life that we're living for is the eternal life, is the afterlife. And he was always talking about that. So, and I know this sounds strange, but over the years, there were a lot of many endings, many deaths, because there's so many endings when you have Parkinson's, little things that we got used to. It was a gradual, slow progression of change. The end of him driving alone, being on his own, talking clear. I mean, there were so many changes and shifts, and they happened gradually. And my biggest fear was not only that my father would pass, it was how. Would he be awake? Would he be in pain? I wanted him to go peaceful. I couldn't imagine how the end would be. I didn't ever read about Parkinson's because I didn't want to know some of the things. I just knew that he handled it well, so I didn't want to have anything in my head negative or fear that I was fearing to happen when it wouldn't even be a fear for him. So I never read about it. I just lived every day with my dad and just, you know, dealt with it that way because he's so spiritual. But he had such a blessed passing that you couldn't have asked for anything better. He just went to sleep. You know, his organs started to fail. They induced a coma. His organs started to fail. He got sepsis. And that was it. He passed, and all of his kids were around him. And, I mean, we all spent his last birthday with him for the first time in years. That hasn't happened, I think, since 2000. Well, no, we were all there for, I think, his 70th birthday. But he got to spend his last birthday with him. I got to spend my last birthday. He was there, you know. So it was so blessed. So I was then the reception of the people on the streets, and it came out and filled the streets, and I was mixed emotions. I was sad because I would never kiss and hug him again. not in his physical plane, in this life. And that was what I cried for more than anything else. Just the fact that I can't hug him anymore, kiss him anymore. It's so, so, so heartbreaking. Not that he was gone and moved on to his next future, you know, journey, because he's free from his body now. You know, it's part of life. He had a blessed life. You can't feel sorry for him. Maybe we all have to die. I couldn't imagine a better way for him to go. So I was had a mixed feeling of relief and happiness, and then the selfish side of human beings, you know, because we're not going to see them anymore. You know, we're going to be sad. That's what made me cry. That's what makes me cry to this day even. You know, I'll be like, Daddy, I'll be driving down the street. And I'll start crying, and then it passes. And I just start talking to him. I talk to his picture. My husband makes fun of me sometimes. I talk to his picture. Daddy, I miss you. Tell him stories. Talk to the universe and to thin air. And I know you're out there. I hope you are. You know, I'm just fear of death a little less now because he's on that other side. So that's the biggest thing that's changed, if anything. I just have this I mean, no one wants to die, but I can't explain it. It's like this feeling of some peacefulness that comes with the thought of it now, just because my dad's over there somewhere. So that's the truth.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say that is the major, the biggest change. I was used to not seeing him all the time. So sometimes I forget he's not here, but he's everywhere and he's loved and he's everywhere. I just feel like he's gone sometimes. The only time I really realize it is when I can't call him, I can't hug him, because he's just always everywhere. You know, everywhere I look, I see my dad's mural on some wall, or someone's talking about him on TV. So, you know, there's another book out, another, he's everywhere. So
yeah,
it's a blessing.
He literally is. I mean, it's amazing to see. You know, because I don't care who comes up through the ranks in the boxing world. I've never seen a humanitarian boxer like Muhammad Ali. You know,
right.
Props to Manny Pacquiao. I know he does a lot of great things in the homeland, Philippines, you know. And there's a lot of people that do a lot of great things. But your father's the greatest.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just because of his exploits in the ring. It's just him as a human being. You're just not going to – I mean, God makes people like Daddy probably win this every few hundred years. So, you're not, I mean, they're special people. Well, my dad would tell you this. If you were praising him, he would love it. But he would say, let me tell you something. There are people all over the world, little towns you never heard of, that live in places where you can't even pronounce the name of, that you'll probably never read about, hear about. They're taking stands every day, standing up for what's right, fighting for causes you've never even know exist. And you never know their name because, you know, no one knows about them because you don't know their name. So he was given a platform, and that's why he knew. But he knows there's people everywhere that are decent and kind and true, but there's very few that are actually in the spotlight. So I think that you just, you know, people knew that Daddy was like the Halley's Comet. You know, you're not going to see another one in your lifetime.
Yeah. You're right. They definitely broke the mold.
I told him he's the eighth wonder of the world. Yeah, I always just tell him, you're the eighth wonder of the world, Daddy. They really should name you the eighth wonder of the world.
Well, and you know, this book gives you insight, you know, like I said earlier, into him, his humanity. You know, it takes away the godlike persona for a minute and shows
right.
you his day-to-day life, and that's very important.
The book is
At Home with Muhammad Ali, and it's out, you said it's out the 7th?
It's out, yeah, May 7th, and it's available now. If you want to pre-order, you can go to athomewithmuhammadali.com.
Definitely. Well, actually, when this interview does air, you guys will be able to go get it, so just make sure you guys go get it right now.
Oh, that's right. That's true.
And,
oh, that's right, we're live, you know, right? And then it's going to be on again, yeah.
Yeah.
And come on,
yeah,
if you're living in Los Angeles, come to the Grove. If you're listening to this before, you know, if you're listening to this before May 7th, I'll be at the Grove at 7 p.m. The Grove is in Los Angeles. It's at the Barnes & Noble at the Grove in Los Angeles at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, May 7th, doing a book signing and discussion.
Are you gonna be doing a book tour?
I'm supposed to be. I don't like to fly, but I am going to be going to New York. I'm not sure yet what the publicist has lined up. She's got some stuff, so I'll know on Monday. But yeah, I'll do a little tour.
Oh, that's awesome! That's awesome. Well, I wish you much success.
Thank you.
From what I read of this so far, it's a phenomenal book.
Thank you.
I really hope everybody goes out and gets it. Before we do get out of here,
if you could say a few words about your father to kind of, I guess, you know, how do you best remember him? Like, what would you like the fans to know how to remember him by? If that makes sense.
Oh, my God. My father, I'm going to tell you what he would say. He would want you to say that he took a few cups of love, a teaspoon of patience, a tablespoon of generosity, and a pint of patience, and mixed them all up and served it to each and every deserving person he met. And that's how he said he wanted to be remembered, as a man who stood up for his people, as a black man who won the championship title of the world, heavyweight title of the world 3 times, that stood up for his people and loved everyone and treated everyone with respect and equality. And he said, I wouldn't even mind if folks forgot how pretty I was. That's how he would say he wanted to be remembered. But I would say, just to have known that my father achieved this title and status of greatness, not because of his exploits in the ring, but because of how he handled the challenges of life, and with the grace and dignity he lived his life with, the kindness of his heart, the generosity of his heart, and the fact that he was so down to earth. He was more down to earth than the average person on the street. And he loved people just as much as they loved him. He respected people. And he just wanted to be an inspiration and a light for everyone that needed it, especially those on the downside of advantage. And he lived his life. He lived it all. He didn't just talk. You know, he was out there in the street, up close and personal, so people can come up to him and touch him and hold him and feel him. And that was as real as any human being could get. And it's just a major accomplishment and just so admirable because of the fame and status that he had, you know. So I always say, people say, how can you explain your father to the world? Like, give me a word. I'm like, there's no word. And then I thought, you know what? There is one word, ineffable, which basically means too great to describe in words.
So, yeah.
He was ineffable, and that's what I'll leave you with. And if you want any more, go get the book. You'll love it. 460 pages of great, great, great memories and candidness, so.
Oh, phenomenal book. Go get it. I do got
Thank
one
you.
More quick one for you, though,
okay.
Hannah. You know, Chuck D and LL Cool J touched on this before, but, you know, Jesse Ventura, when he was reciting I Am the Greatest, he said that Muhammad Ali should get credit for hip-hop, that he was really the hip-hop, true hip-hop pioneer. Can you talk a little bit about that and how much of an influence your father was on the hip-hop genre?
Well, I don't know how much of an influence he was on hip-hop, but I do know that he did rhyme and predict rounds in which, and I don't really listen to rap and hip-hop that much, so I wouldn't know, but I do know that it is the truth, because if you look back and watch all of his old tapes and footage, and he was rhyming and predicting, and I guess they can't find anyone that precedes my father doing it, so I think that's why they're giving him that title and credit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
something else to add to Zach Blades. He'd like that.
Definitely. Again, great book,
At
Home with Muhammad Ali by Hannah Ali. Thank you so much for calling for this interview tonight.
Thank you.
You take care.
Thank you. Cheers.